In the classic American version of the sitcom The Office, there's a multi-episode subplot in season 6 in which the character Dwight Schrute, played by Rainn Wilson, starts plotting how he can get the character Jim Halpert, played by John Krasinski, who is the co-manager of The Office, to do something stupid so that he can get fired from his position as co-manager. This is because Dwight, who is probably best described as Jim's frenemy, is absolutely convinced that he should have been the one to get the co-manager position, not Jim. For those of you who have seen the show, you know that Dwight always likes to refer to himself as the assistant regional manager, but his real title is the assistant to the regional manager. And there's a huge difference there. So in an effort to discredit Jim, Dwight, there in season 6, starts doing all kinds of things, like bugging Jim's office so that he can catch Jim saying something that is worthy of his being dismissed from the position of co-manager, to rigging an employee of the month vote so that it looks like Jim votes for himself to be the employee of the month and thus gets everybody to turn against him. And all of it is ultimately geared towards Jim's downfall. That's what Dwight wants. He wants him to lose his position. He's setting up one trap after another trap after another trap, all just to get Jim to have a downfall. Well, a similar but perhaps much more malicious thing is taking shape in our gospel lesson this morning. As Mark notes at the very outset of our pericope this morning, some Pharisees came, and to test Jesus, they asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" Now, right here, at the beginning of this passage, Mark makes it abundantly clear that the Pharisees have no real interest in having any kind of theological debate or having any kind of conversation with Jesus about what his views of divorce are. That is not why they are coming to him saying, "Hey, Jesus, we heard some rumors. We kind of want to get it from you, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, what you think about this topic of divorce." They're not interested in that at all. No, the whole thing is nothing more than a trap. That's what Mark says. They came to test Jesus, to trap Jesus. So they want to take Jesus down, and so they're going to ask him a question that they hope will lead Jesus to incriminate himself. But here's a question: who are they trying to get Jesus in trouble with? Because to have a trap of this sort, one has to have a judge out there. One has to have someone that it's possible to get in trouble with. So who is it that they are trying to get Jesus in trouble with? Well, this is where taking the gospel according to Mark as a whole, that is, reading this particular lesson within its larger context, helps us immensely. If you recall, and we're in chapter 10 of Mark with this reading today, if you recall, back in chapter 6 of Mark's gospel, Jesus' forerunner, the Elijah-like character known as John the Baptizer or John the Baptist, had gotten himself into trouble with Herod Archelaus, who is the sort of governor of the region around Jerusalem. His official title is Tetrarch. He had gotten himself in trouble with Herod for having called out Herod and his wife Herodias for the illegitimacy of their marriage under the law of God. You see, both Herod and Herodias had been married to other people, and they decided that they no longer wanted to be married to their respective spouses because they had struck up a romance with one another, and they were now going to be together in a marriage. And so they had both divorced, and they had both come together. And the truly disturbing part of this is that Herodias had been married to Herod's brother. You talk about Peyton Place or Melrose Place, you know. This is twisted stuff. She fell in love with her husband's brother. So John has basically told them that it wasn't lawful under the law of God for Herod, who was the so-called king of the Jews, and that's a really key piece here, to do this. Consequently, this led to John's arrest by Herod, and it led to Herod being lured in what we could best describe as a drunken orgy. that was put on by Herodias and her daughter to have John the Baptist put to death by having his head chopped off. So since that time, Mark tells us, Herod is living in deep suspicion about Jesus because he thinks that Jesus is John the Baptist come back to life. So he is desperately fearful that this guy who had attacked him about his divorce, about his unlawful marriage, has now come back from the dead in the person of Jesus and is going to come back for some more. So back to my question, who are the Pharisees trying to get Jesus in trouble with? The answer contextually is Herod. They're trying to get him in trouble with Herod. What they want here is to show that Jesus is in league with John the Baptist in his view of divorce so that Herod will turn around in his fearfulness and have Jesus arrested and possibly have Jesus put to death in the same way that John was put to death. That's what they're hoping for. Now, that's really important for us to keep in mind as we look at this text. So Jesus starts out his response to the Pharisees' trap by asking them what Moses commanded. In other words, Jesus points them back to the law of God, and he asks them to answer from there. What does the law of God say? So you ask a law question, because that's what they asked, is it lawful? Ask a law question, you get a law answer. And how do they respond? They say, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to divorce a certificate of dismissal and to divorce her. To which Jesus responds, because of your hardness of heart, he wrote this commandment for you. In other words, Moses did not advocate divorce for the people of Israel, but he assumed the reality of divorce, and then he wrote a law that made a concession to it. That's key. He did not advocate divorce. That's how they're interpreting it. But he recognized the reality of divorce, and he wrote a law to make a concession to it. And that concession that Moses wrote is in Deuteronomy 24. One of the background pieces you need to understand in order to make sense of it is that in Moses' day, the man had all the power. The man had all the legal rights. And that meant only the man could initiate the divorce. But what was feared, of course, is that you would get a husband who would dislike his wife in some way, shape, or form. Later rabbis in Jesus's day said that you could divorce your wife if she cooked you a bad meal. Or if you just didn't like her anymore. She smelled bad or something like that. These were all grounds for divorce. So the fear, of course, was that divorce was going to take a sort of willy-nilly shape. And Moses' big concern, and obviously the Lord who lays back of that, was to protect the woman from the man who might divorce her in that willy-nilly fashion and later decide, after she's gone on to be joined to another husband, that he wanted her back. That's what Moses is protecting against in Deuteronomy 24. So God is setting up protection here. He doesn't want the husband treating the marriage like it's nothing more than some form of dysfunctional dating, because that's the possible reality there. But this is when Jesus pushes even further back than the law in Deuteronomy 24. And Jesus says to the Pharisees, let's step out of a law discussion here. And let's go back to God's intention in creation. Let's push it all the way back to the beginning. Even though divorce is a reality, is divorce God's intention in creating humans, male and female? And the answer, of course, is no. As Jesus puts it, but from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Now, this is exactly what we heard in our Old Testament lesson this morning from the book of Genesis. Funny how that works out, isn't it? That's what Jesus is pointing them back to. God's intention in creating man and woman is that they would come together in a lasting one flesh union for their mutual help and their mutual support. This is beautifully pictured there in that narrative in Genesis by the fact that the woman is, the rib is taken out of the man, and the woman is fashioned from the rib, so there's a part of him missing. And when his wife is given back to him, that piece of him that is missing is given back so that the two together now form a whole, one complete unit. That's what we mean when we talk about them being one flesh. They are one unit together. And so as Jesus tells the disciples later on when they ask him about that, to rip that one flesh union apart that God created and that God intended, to rip that apart and to enter into other one flesh unions is to create what he calls a situation of adultery, right? That word adultery at its core carries the idea of split loyalties. You know, there's something beautiful to having a singularity in your loyalty. And when you have split loyalties, that creates complications in life. And that's kind of what underlies a lot of what Jesus is getting that at there, that this makes life far more complicated than God had ever intended. And this is, by the way, precisely what Herod and Herodias had done. Herod and Herodias had rent their unions apart so that they could selfishly form the one union born out of their lust. So Jesus is in league with John the Baptist on this matter. That's the clear thing that comes through the gospel lesson. And by the way, it is placed by Mark. We skipped verse 1. For some reason, they chopped verse 1 out of our lesson this morning. Verse 1 makes it clear that Jesus has begun his march to Jerusalem to die on the cross. So here at the beginning, the animosity against Jesus is building up right from the get-go because it's clear he's in league with John the Baptist, and that is not going to sit well with the authorities. Now, we have to admit that these words of Jesus that he speaks here are a little hard. I am keenly aware that some of you have gone through the process of divorce, that you have experienced the reality of it. And perhaps that makes Jesus' words rub against the grain a little bit, or perhaps it makes Jesus' words cut like a knife a bit. Sometimes that happens. People hear this gospel lesson and it creates a lot of guilt and a lot of anxiety within them. But here's what I need to say as your pastor. We live in a broken world where things don't often go the way that we originally intend for them to go. And that goes for marriage as well. Many times, more often than not, we enter into marriage fully intending to keep and uphold the commitments that we make there when we take those marriage vows. You know, this is part of what the church's responsibility is when we meet with people for premarital counseling, is to figure out if this is really an intention to stay together, or if this is just somebody thinking, well, this is like a glorified version of dating. If it doesn't work out, we've got our fingers crossed behind our back, right? We'll just move on. That's part of the church's responsibility when we meet with people. So I think more often than not, we enter into these commitments fully intending to keep them, and then we find out that for a host of reasons, things fall apart. Things come down. Sometimes, in the case of emotional, physical, psychological, or sexual abuse, that may mean that the marriage needs to come to an end. It has to come to an end for the safety of one of the parties involved, or if there's children involved, perhaps for them as well. And there are other times when issues of things like infidelity or some form of betrayal or drifting apart come into play, and when that happens, a couple should always seek to do what they can do to try to reconcile, to try to work that out. And there are times when people do engage in that to try to salvage the relationship, to bring healing to the relationship. And sometimes that works. And sometimes, because one party is unwilling to cooperate, or one party has just built up such a wall of animosity, that it doesn't work. It just doesn't happen. The healing and the restoration just can't take shape. And so a divorce comes about. And that can be heartbreaking, and that can be devastating. And I don't think that I've hardly ever met anybody who was thrilled with the fact that they had gone through a divorce. There's always some pain involved with it. There's always some heartbreak involved in it, and we have to make no bones about that. You know, in the Episcopal Church, we don't play games like our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters have sometimes done with trying to pretend that a divorce really isn't happening here, and we'll call it an annulment instead. You know, we acknowledge the reality of divorce. It's awful, it hurts, and it's part of our struggles in a sinful world. But we also recognize that there's hope, and I'll get to that in a moment. We always recognize there's hope. So we have to make no bones about it. You know, these things are painful. They're heartbreaking. And we can't pretend, as is happening in our culture right now, that divorce is just a flat-out good thing. You know, you can't do Chris Martin and Gwyneth Paltrow's conscious uncoupling, right? This was just a wonderful splitting apart. We'll have a celebration. Give me a break. But through all of this, we need to remember who it is who's speaking these words to us. The one who's speaking these words is the one who made us male and female, and the one who created marriage as a good and holy thing. God created that marriage of that vocation of marriage as a good and holy thing. For a man and a woman to be brought together as a one flesh union is a wonderful gift. God is the one who intends the best for us in marriage, and gives us that as a gift. You know, it's not Al Bundy here in Married with Children, where it's like the marriage is the albatross hanging around our neck kind of thing. But he also knows all too well our sinful proclivities. God knows this. He knows how we've made a mess of things, and how we make a mess of things, and how we've broken the world around us. And that's why he came into the world for us. That's why he came, to suffer the consequences for our sin, to suffer the consequences for the brokenness of this world in himself, so that we wouldn't have to. He came to bear that sin down for us into death, so that we might know the joy and the peace of his forgiveness, because that's what he wants us to live in and be confident of. And that's just as true in the situation of divorce as it is of any other sinful area in our lives, any other area of brokenness in our lives. Divorce is not some sort of unforgivable sin. And unfortunately, I think sometimes that's gotten played out in the church. But you know, we really don't say that. It is not some sort of unforgivable thing hanging out there. We realize that it happens, and we realize that God brings healing, that God can bring new life, that God can bring new growth. So to put this very simply, if you have gone through a divorce, and if you carry guilt and burden around that, and you feel that heartbreak and the pain, please know that God forgives you, and that God does not hold that against you in any way, shape, or form. After all, God is a God of resurrection who desires nothing more than to raise us up from those places where we've fallen. And that's part of the reason why in the church we practice remarriage, because we recognize that God can bring about new life, even in those places where things have died, where things have fallen apart. So when it comes to this goodness that God has to us, he calls us to be like children. And that's the second part of our lesson today. He calls us to be like children. That is to be nothing more than dependent receivers, people who know their needs and who come to him with empty hands held out like children do with their parents. And that's really what being a childlike is about for Jesus. It's not, as is sometimes said, about being innocent. Children aren't innocent. If you think they are, you need to spend more time around them. Okay? That's not the picture that Jesus is trying to paint, that we need to be like innocent little children around him. Remember what I've said the last few weeks when it's come to children. Children in Jesus' day are on the bottom tier of society. They're people that cannot do for themselves, but simply live in a place with outstretched hand, needing people to give to them, needing to be receivers. That's what Jesus means when it comes to being childlike. He calls us to be the kind of people that don't try to take things on ourselves, that don't try to be in control, but people that put our hands out and say, I can't do it. I need help. That's what your children did, right, when they were little. Nobody takes a one-year-old and says, okay, you're good now. I want you to go cook your own dinner and clean up the mess in the kitchen. It's not going to happen, right? But your children at 1 year old have their hands out, and they need to be fed. They need to be given to. And that's what Jesus calls for us to be as well, people that have our hands out so that he may place all the good that he has to give us into our hands. And that good is his love. That good is his forgiveness. That good is the promise of new life. That good is the hope and the peace and the joy that only he can give. And God knows we need peace and hope and joy in this world that we're living in right now. So that's how we enter the kingdom of God, with our sins forgiven and with nothing but empty and open hands to receive all those good things that God has to pour out on us in Jesus Christ. Amen.